The Pat Miller Program, from the Windows, Doors, and More Studio. Visit the showroom for your kitchen and bath inspirations on WoWo, 1190 AM, 107.5 FM. Depend on it.
On this Tuesday, we roll into this, the third final hour of the day in the 5 o'clock hour. Let's waste no more time, shall we? Let's get to the newsmaker line. And they're from Real Clear Politics. He is the White House correspondent for them. It's our own Philip Wegman. Philip, good afternoon to you, sir.
Hey, Pat. How are you doing?
Okay. Now, listen, you are in D.C. You're not one of the pool reporters that's out with the president today. Is that right?
I am not. He is in Detroit, Michigan, and from the pool reports that I'm getting, President Biden is more than happy, because normally presidents are not allowed to drive themselves while in office. But he's a motorhead, and he got behind the new Ford Lightning, which is insanely fast.
Yes, and I just saw him, and in what seemed like a sweet, cute, teasing fashion, some reporter was trying to ask him questions through the open side window, and the president almost half said something about running over him with the vehicle.
Yeah, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. If Donald Trump had said anything similar to that, it would
be a
news cycle in and of itself. But I think that Biden was kidding there, and I think that he deserves props, because he really did floor it. Normally, politicians do this thing where they pretend to be everyday regular people. But from the video and audio that I saw, I mean, wheels were squealing. He burned some rubber there, and regardless of your politics, good for him.
Yeah, one thing I want you to find for your own entertainment. Nobody else is listening to us, Philip, but just for your own entertainment, get on YouTube and do a search for Richard Nixon and Leonid Brezhnev and Camp David, because they were there. The Secret Service just about wet themselves. They were there, and they had some big car. It was like a GTO or something out there at Camp David. And the president drove him around, and then President Brezhnev wanted to drive it for a while. So he got behind the wheel, and I guess he scared the holy thunder out of Nixon. And everybody else, and I guess the Secret Service were like, okay, we could never let this happen again. So that was...
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because... President Obama wanted to do the show Cars and Coffee with Jerry Seinfeld, just this little Netflix show where they test drive an exotic vintage car. And the Secret Service would not allow President Obama to drive outside of the White House parking lot because of, safety considerations. And then Vice President Biden at the time, ahead of the 2016 election, he has a sweet 1967 Corvette, and it's in green, and he wasn't able to drive it until he was headed out of office. So he actually met up with Jay Leno. There's a really cool episode of Jay Leno's Garage where Biden got behind the wheel of that thing once again. And, he knows how to drive.
Hey, from news anchor par excellence, my own Brian Davis, who just shot me a text from the newsroom, it was in fact Brezhnev and Nixon, and it was a 1973 Lincoln Continental. So I go back to my original statement, it was a boat, okay, and it probably had like a 500 in it or something. So
yeah, they were built differently back then.
A little bit differently, yep. So let's talk. We've been talking a little bit for the last half hour with our listeners, but let's get your take. HR1 is really being bandied about and pushed, and it's being told. I don't want to give you my take on it, because I want to hear yours. I'm being told by the Democrats that this would fix everything that was wrong with the election in 2020 and make sure it would never happen again. A, is that true? And B, do you think that's the motivation behind wanting to pass HR1?
Perhaps, maybe their motivations are pure and not driven by just the pursuit of power. But again, we're talking about politicians, so so take their argument with a grain of salt. The thing to remember about H.R. 1, which would essentially federalize a lot of the standards around election law, is that this was not something that was cooked up post-2020. Instead, a lot of this legislation was already put forward before this this last presidential cycle. So there was already an impetus to do this, and then sort of the hook to bring it around once again were some of these questions surrounding the 2020 election. The reason conservatives don't like it is essentially they think that it would seize authority from the states, and their argument is by implementing early voting and automatic voter registration and same day registration, that this would give the federal government a lot more power while making it more difficult for states to make certain that the people who are allowed to vote are the ones who are actually going to the polls.
Yeah, and again, that brings back the age-old argument, doesn't it? Exactly. Tell me again, how is it that having voter ID to be able to vote is somehow voter suppression? We ask them to do it to show it for getting their driver's licenses. Is that driver suppression? When you do it to get your tickets to the Super Bowl, is that football suppression? I mean, it's just amazing how something is absolutely legal, makes all the sense in the world, until it comes to voting, and then it's suppression, and you're doing it because you're a fearmonger and because of your hatred of certain races or cultures of people. That has never, ever made sense to me.
Democrats are in a really difficult situation with this argument about voter ID because polling shows again and again and again that the majority of the public is behind the idea of voter ID. Because, look, if you fill out any federal form, more often than not, you're not just going to have to provide one set of ID, but two. I mean, Americans just filed taxes, and not only did they have to put down their driver's license number, they also had to, provide last year's returns, a number of different things to ensure that the federal government knows that the person actually filing the return is the person that they say they are. This also, it's just common sense. And Democrats put themselves in a situation when they advocate for not having voter ID at the polls, but then elsewhere, there are all of these other examples that everyday people just see and say, well, hey, this makes sense.
There was some recent polling to back up the numbers you talked about a while ago that 77% of voters support voter ID requirements, including 62% of Biden voters. Well, that's almost 2-1. I mean, that's just absolutely amazing. And yet I'm not hearing those numbers out there a whole lot.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is that there were a lot of things that were put in place as a result of the pandemic. You had voter drop boxes, you had extended early voting, all sorts of things that made sense when we were in a once-in-a-century pandemic. The Republican argument is, all right, well, those were emergency measures. They don't need to be there from now on. Instead, let's roll those back. And I think that, people in my industry do their readers a disservice when they say that sort of thing is voter suppression. I mean, look, voter suppression does happen. Anyone who doubts that should look at sort of the redistricting that occurs all the time.
Yep.
Saying, look, once we're done with a pandemic that is deadly, we expect people to absentee vote or go to the polls like normal. That's not as much of a scary thing as I think a lot of my colleagues unfortunately make it out to be.
Well, the scariest of all of it is that it is a huge step toward nationalizing elections, which and most people are not even aware of the difference between federal government and states' rights and things like that. But if you pull elections and the validation of elections, if you pull that away from states, your need for states starts to go away.
So we were talking about redistricting a second ago, and one of the things that's really interesting about HR 1 as it's put forth right here is that it would essentially change it from allowing state legislatures to draw congressional lines to instead allow independent commissions to draw those election lines. And mm-hmm. on the surface, this sort of makes sense. We think, well, why have politicians draw these congressional lines to their own benefit? Shouldn't we have some sort of, expert who's just going to do this on their own? Well, no, the conservative would argue, because that commission is made up of people who are, one, self-interested, and then, two, are unaccountable. And I think that when we are having these questions about our election law, yeah, some things need to change. Certainly some states have been able to change, for the better, but it's when you have individual states making these decisions and their electorate weighing in on how to make them better, that things actually improve. I mean, if you look at Florida, for instance, my first political memory is waking up and asking my parents if we knew who the president was after the 2000 election. Florida was just a national disgrace and nightmare, and it was embarrassing. What did the Florida legislature do? They turned around and decided to have one of the most efficient and transparent voting processes and they put it in place.
Yeah, a state realized their shortcoming. And they fixed their own problem, and they have been a model ever since. Let me ask you a question. This is a personal question. You may or may not want to answer this. So, so are you ever going to get married or not? No, that wasn't a question. I'm in a mood today, just so you know. Okay, I've been fighting computers and stuff all day long. Now, but let me ask you this. You come from Northeast Indiana. Your upbringing has been somewhat conservative all along the way. You went to Hillsdale, which is a bastion of, if not full-fledged conservatism, at least constitutionalism. You came away, your sister came away from Hillsdale with a great working knowledge of what the Constitution is and what it does. Now that you've spent some period of time in D.C., I know that you realize that if you're a constitutional conservative, you are hugely in the minority there. But is it harder for you to be a constitutional conservative because of those with whom you rub shoulders? Or has it actually helped you be more galvanized to what it is that you are and what you want to be? I've always wanted to ask you that.
Well, no one pays me for my opinion now. In my last job at the Washington Examiner, they had me writing editorials and giving my take. Now I'm much more in a reporting lane.
Yeah, but you're on the news side.
I'm on the news side. But it would be foolish and dishonest for any reporter to say that they can write a story that is not biased. I think all of us, to a degree, have our own biases. I mean, our circumstances and our upbringing, that does determine how we see things. And so while it might not ever be possible to be completely non-biased, it's always possible to be fair. And so I don't think that the idea of just pure objectivity is necessarily, possible, but fairness always is. And I think that what I'm blessed to have is a background in the way conservatives think and the way they approach problems. And that is helpful in terms of reporting, because a lot of my colleagues, when they cover conservatives, the right, or Republicans, they more often than not, coming from a liberal background, treat conservatives and Republicans as zoo animals and sort of gorillas in the mist. And that does not help anyone's understanding. In fact, if we are trying to come up with consensus and bipartisanship and solve problems, that makes it more difficult. And so in my approach to the job, you know, I look at things differently than a Harvard graduate who interned at the New York Times would. And I think that hopefully that makes my perspective a little bit more interesting.
Okay, 45-second answer to that, got to get out of here, but you piqued my curiosity now. On the other side, those that are left, those that are liberal in the press and everything, do you feel, and this is a judgment call, which isn't fair, but do you feel that many people you know, not all of them, but many people you know in the press who are on the left because they're with the Times or NBC or whomever, that they are acting out the part they're expected to play and they're not necessarily holding to a position because it's a rock-ribbed position from deep within them?
I don't want to impugn the motives of my colleagues, but certainly our industry hasn't covered itself in glory in the last 4 years. I think that some of the best reporters, you know, even if they are liberal, they acknowledge that that's how they approach the news and their job, and that's how they see things. I think that if you acknowledge that you have a perspective and then make certain that that perspective doesn't make the story unfair, then you're all right. It's when you just sort of go along with you know, mm-hmm. the status quo or groupthink that you get into trouble.
Yeah, the go along to get along, and whether or not you act like it is a rock-rid position or not. That's the thing. And sometimes I can almost see it in some of their eyes. It's almost like, hey, I'm not really buying this, but here's the line I need to come out with, you know? And it just, I would hate to live a life like that. Hey, listen, Philip, I always appreciate you. When my podcast gets up and running here in about 30 days, I need to have you as one of my first guests on the podcast. And
that sounds fun.
Yeah, and I might, you know, I might give you a gift, like, you know, a free Pizza Hut coupon or something like that. So just, you can.
Hey, I'm always hungry. Thanks, Matt.
Yeah, see, you're a single man in D.C. Who would turn down free food? Philip Wegman for Real Clear Politics. As always, my good friend, thank you so very much for being with us. I appreciate you.
Hey, anytime. Have a good one.
Podcasts by Federated Media. Podcasts by Federated Media.